Chapter 17. Pink Ribbons. Cold winds gusted through the Mulhara, lifting Matt's cloak and threatening to freeze the mud caking his clothing as he and Noel hurried out of the alley. The sun sat on the rooftops, half-hidden, and the shadows stretched long. With one hand for his staff, and the other gripping the broken cord of the fox head stuffed into a coat pocket where he could snatch it out if need be, he had to let his cloak go where it would. He ached from head to foot. The dice rattled warning inside his skull, and he hardly noticed either thing. He was too busy trying to watch every direction at once, and wondering just how small a hole that thing could get through. He found himself uneasily eyeing cracks between the square's paving stones, though it hardly seemed likely the thing would come at him in the open. A hum carried from surrounding streets, but here only a slat-ribbed dog moved, running past the fountained statue of long-dead Queen Narian. Some said her uplifted hand pointed to the ocean's bounty that had enriched Ebudar, and some that it pointed in warning of dangers. Others said her successor had wanted to draw attention to the fact that only one of the statue's breasts was uncovered, proclaiming that Narian had only been of middling honesty. In other days, the Mulhara would have been full of strolling lovers and lingering street vendors and hopeful beggars at this hour, even in winter. But beggars found themselves snatched off the streets and put to work since the Seanchan came, and the rest stayed away even in daylight. The reason was the Tarasin Palace, that great mound of white domes and marble spires and wrought iron balconies, the residence of Talan Quintara Mitsubar, by the grace of the light, Queen of Altara, or as much of Altara as lay within a few days' ride of Ebudar, mistress of the four winds and guardian of the Sea of Storms. And, perhaps more important, the residence of the High Lady Suroth, Sabel Meldarath, commanding the forerunners for the Empress of the Seanchan, might she live forever. A position of much greater eminence in Ebudar at the moment. Thailand's green-booted guards stood at every entrance in their baggy white trousers and gilded breastplates worn over green coats, and so did men and women in those insectile helmets with armor striped in blue and yellow or green and white, or any other combination you might happen to think of. The Queen of Altara required security and silence for her rest. Or rather, Suroth said she did, and what Suroth said Thailand wanted, Thailand soon decided that she did indeed want. After a moment's consideration, Matt led Noel to one of the stable-yard gates. There was more chance of getting a stranger in there than if he used the grand marble stairs that led down into the square, not to mention a much better chance of getting all the mud off him before he had to face Thailand. She had made her displeasure markedly known the last time he came back disheveled after a tavern brawl. A handful of Ebudari guards stood to one side of the open gates with halberds, and the same number of Seanchan on the other with tasseled spears, all as stiff as Narian's statue. "The light's blessing on all here," Matt murmured politely to the Ebudari guards. It was always best to be polite to Ebudari until you were sure of them. Afterwards, too, for that matter. Even so, they were more flexible than the Seanchan. "And on to you, my lord," their stocky officer replied, ambling forward, and Matt recognized him. "Sullivan Sarat, a good fellow, always ready with a quip and possessing a fine eye for horses." Shaking his head, Sullivan tapped the side of his pointed helmet with the thin gilded rod of his office. "Have you been in another fight, my lord? She will go up like a waterspout when she sees you." Squaring his shoulders and trying not to lean so obviously on his staff, Matt bristled. Ready with a quip? Come to think on it, the Sundark man had a tongue like a rasp, and his eye for horses was not all that fine either. "Will there be any questions if my friend here beds down with my men?" Matt asked roughly. "There shouldn't be. There's room for one more with my fellows." Room for more than one, truth be told. 8 men had died so far, following him to Ebudar. "None from me, my lord," Sullivan said, though he eyed the scrawny man at Matt's side and pursed his lips judiciously. Noel's coat appeared of good quality, though, at least in the dim light, and he did have his lace, and in a better state than Matt's. Perhaps that tipped the balance. And she doesn't need to know everything, so none from her either. Matt scowled, but before intemperate words could put himself and Noel in the soup kettle, three armored Shonshan galloped up to the gate, and Sullivan turned to face them.
"You and your lady wife live in the Queen's palace?"
Noel inquired, starting toward the gate. Matt pulled him back. "Wait on them," he said, nodding toward the Shonshan. His lady wife? Bloody women? Bloody dice in his bloody head?
"I have dispatches for the High Lady Surath," one of the Shonshan announced, slapping a leather satchel hanging from one armored shoulder. Her helmet bore a single thin plume, marking her a low-ranking officer, yet her horse was a tall dun gelding with a look of speed.
The other two animals were sturdy enough, but there was nothing to be said for them beyond that.
"Enter with the blessings of the light," Sullivan said, bowing slightly.
The Shonshan woman's bow from her saddle was a mirror of his.
"The blessings of the light be on you also," she drawled, and the three of them clattered into the stable yard.
"It is very strange," Sullivan mused, peering after the three. "They always ask permission of us, not them." He flicked his rod toward the Shonshan guards on the other side of the gates. They had not stirred an inch from their rigid stance or even glanced at the arrivals that Matt had noticed.
"And what would they do if you said they couldn't go in?"
Noel asked quietly, easing the bundle on his back. Sullivan spun on his heel.
"It is enough that I have given oath to my queen," he said in an expressionless voice. "And she has given hers, where she has given it. Give your friend a bed, my lord, and warn him there are things better left unsaid in Ebu Dar. Questions better left unasked."
Noel looked befuddled and began protesting that he was simply curious, but Matt exchanged further benisons and courtesies with the Altaran officer, as quickly as he could, to be sure, and hustled his newfound acquaintance through the gates, explaining about listeners in a low voice. The man might have saved his hide from the Golam, but that did not mean he would let the fellow hand it over to the Shonshan. They had people called Seekers, too. And from the little he had heard, even people who spoke freely about the Death Watch Guard locked their teeth when it came to the Seekers. From the little he had heard, Seekers made White Cloak questioners look like boys tormenting flies. Nasty, but hardly anything to worry a man.
"I see," the old man said slowly. "I hadn't known that."
He sounded irritated with himself.
"You must spend a good deal of time with the Shonshan. Do you know the High Lady Surath as well, then? I must say I had no idea you had such high connections."
"I spend time with soldiers in taverns when I can," Matt replied sourly.
When Tylin let him. Light, he might as well be married.
"Surath doesn't know I'm alive."
And he devoutly hoped it remained that way. The three Shonshan were already out of sight, their horses being led into the stables, but several dozen Suldam were giving Damani their evening exercise, walking them in a big circle around the stone-paved yard. Nearly half the gray-clad Damani were dark-skinned women, lacking the jewelry they had worn as windfinders. There were more like them in the palace and elsewhere. The Shonshan had had a rich harvest from seafolk vessels that had failed to escape. Most wore sullen resignation or stony faces, but seven or eight stared ahead of them, lost and confused, disbelieving still. Each of those had a Shonshan-born Damani at her side, holding her hand or with an arm around her, smiling and whispering to her under the approving eyes of the women who wore the bracelets attached to their silvery collars. A few of those dazed women clutched the Damani walking with them as if holding to lifelines. It would have been enough to make Matt shiver if his damp clothes had not already been doing the job. He tried to hurry Noel across the yard, but the circle brought a Damani who was neither Shonshan nor Athaan Mier near him, linked to a plump, graying Suldam, an olive-skinned woman who might have passed for Altaran and someone's mother. A stern mother, with possibly a fractious child from the way she regarded her charge. Teslin Baradin had fleshed out after a month and a half in Shonshan captivity. yet her ageless face still looked as if she ate briars 3 meals a day. On the other hand, she walked placidly on her leash and obeyed the Suldam's murmured directions without hesitation, pausing to bow very deeply to him and Noel. For an instant, though, her dark eyes flashed hatred at him before she and the Suldam continued their circuit of the stable yard. Placidly, obediently. He had seen Damani upended and switched till they howled in this same stable yard for making any sort of fuss, Teslin among them. She had done him no good turns, and maybe a few bad, but he would not have wished this on her. "Better than being dead, I suppose," he muttered, moving on. Teslin was a hard woman, likely plotting every moment how to escape, yet hardness only took you so far. The mistress of the ships and her master of the blades had died on the stake without ever screaming, but it had not saved them.
"Do you believe that?"
Noel asked absently, fumbling awkwardly with his bundle again. His broken hands had handled that knife well enough, but they seemed clumsy at everything else. Matt frowned at him. No, he was not sure he believed it. Those silver eidom seemed too much like the invisible collar Tylan had on him. Then again, Tylan could tickle him under the chin the rest of his life, if it kept him off the stake. Lighty wished those bloody dice in his head would just stop and get it over with. No, that was a lie. Since he had finally realized what they meant, he had never wanted the dice to stop. The room Chell Vannin and the surviving Red Arms shared lay not far from the stables, a long white-plastered chamber with a low ceiling and too many beds for those who remained alive. Vannin, a balding, suety heap, was lying on one in his shirt sleeves, an open book propped on his chest. Matt was surprised the man could read. Spitting through a gap in his teeth, Vannin eyed Matt's mud-smeared clothes.
"You've been fighting again?" he asked. "She won't like that, I reckon."
He did not rise. With a few startling exceptions, Vannin considered himself as good as any lord or lady.
"Trouble, Lord Matt,"
Arnon growled, leaping to his feet. He was a solid man, physically and by temperament, but his heavy jaw clenched, twisting the hawk crudely tattooed on his cheek.
"Begging your pardon, but you're in no condition for it. Tell us what he looks like and we'll sort him out for you."
The last three gathered behind him with eager expressions, two grabbing for their coats while still tucking in shirt tails. Metwin, a boyish-appearing Kyrianin, who was 10 years older than Matt, instead picked up his sword from where it was propped at the foot of his bed and eased a little of the blade out of the scabbard to check the edge. He was the best of them with a sword, very good indeed, though Gorderon came close for all he looked a blacksmith. Gorderon was not nearly as slow as his thick shoulders made him appear. 12 Red Arms had followed Matt Koth and Dwebudar. 8 of those were dead, and the rest were stuck here in the palace, where they could not pinch the maids, get into a fight over dice, and drink till they fell on their faces, as they could staying at an inn and knowing the innkeeper would see them carried up to their beds, though maybe with their purses a little lighter than they had been.
"Noel can tell you what happened better than I can," Matt replied, pushing his hat back on his head. "He'll be bedding in here with you. He saved my life tonight."
That brought exclamations of shock and cries of approbation for Noel, not to mention slaps on the back that almost toppled the old fellow. Vannin went so far as to mark his place in the book with a fat finger and sit up on the side of his thin mattress. Setting his bundle down on a vacant bed, Noel told the tale with elaborate gestures, playing down his own role, and even making himself a bit of a buffoon, slipping in the mud and gaping at the golem, while Matt fought like a champion. The man was a natural storyteller, as good as a gleeman for making you see what he described. Harnan and the Red Arms laughed genially, knowing what he was about, not stealing their captain's thunder, and approving of it. But laughter died when he came to Matt's attacker slipping away through a tiny hole in a wall. "He made you see that, too." Vannin put down his book and spat through his teeth again. The golem had left Vannin and Harnan half dead in the Rahad. Half dead because it was after other prey.
"The thing wants me for some reason, it seems," Matt said lightly when the old man finished and sank onto the bed with his belongings, seemingly exhausted. "It probably played a dice with me sometime I don't recall. None of you has to worry, as long as you don't get between it and me."
He grinned, trying to make it all a joke, but no one so much as smiled. In any case, I'll parcel out gold to you in the morning. You'll book passage in the first ship leaving for Ilion, and take Ulver with you. Tom and Julin, too, if they'll go. He imagined the thief catcher would, anyway. And Nerum, and Lopin, of course. He had gotten used to having a pair of serving men look after him, but he hardly needed them here. Talmanis must be somewhere close to Camelin by this time. You shouldn't have much trouble finding him. When they were gone, he would be alone with Tylan. Light, he would rather face the golem again. Harnan and the other three red arms exchanged looks, Fergin scratching his head as if he did not quite understand. He might not. The bony man was a good soldier, not the best mind, but good enough, yet he was not very bright when it came to other things.
That wouldn't be right, Harnan allowed finally. One thing, Lord Talmanis would have our hides if we came back without you.
The other three nodded. Fergin could understand that. And you, Vannin? Matt asked. The fat man shrugged.
I take that boy away from Rizel, and he'll gut me like a trout the first time I go to sleep. I would myself in his boots. Anyway, I got time to read here. Don't get much chance for that, working as a farrier.
That was one of the itinerant trades he claimed to follow. The other was stableman. In truth, he was a horse thief and poacher, the best in two countries and maybe more.
You're all mad, Matt said with a frown. Just because it wants me doesn't mean it won't kill you if you get in the way.
The offer stays open. Anyone who comes to his senses can go.
I have seen your like before,
Noel said suddenly. The stooped old man was the image of hard age and exhaustion, but his eyes were bright and sharp, studying Matt.
Some men have an air about them that makes other men follow where they lead. Some lead to devastation, others to glory. I think your name may go into the history books.
Harnan looked as confused as Fergin. Vannin spat and lay back down, opening his book.
If all my luck goes away, maybe, Matt muttered.
He knew what it took to get into the histories. A man could get killed doing that sort of thing.
Better clean up before she sees you, Fergin piped up suddenly. All that mud will put a burr under her saddle for sure.
Snatching his hat off angrily, Matt stalked out without a word. Well, he stalked as well as he could, hobbling on a walking staff. Before the door closed behind him, he heard Noel starting a story about one time he sailed on a seafolk ship and learned to bathe in cold salt water. At least, that was how it began. He intended to get himself clean before Tylan saw him. He did. But as he limped through hallways hung with the flowered tapestries Abudari called summer hangings, for the season they evoked, four serving men in the palace's green and white livery and no fewer than seven maids suggested he might want to bathe and change his clothes before the queen saw him, offering to draw him a bath and fetch clean garments without her learning of it. They did not know everything about him and Tylan, thank the light. No one but Tylan and himself knew the worst bits, but they knew too bloody much. Worse, they approved every last flaming servant in the whole flaming Taurusan palace. For one thing, Tylan was queen, and could do as she pleased, so far as they were concerned. For another, her temper had been on a razor's edge since the Seanchan captured the city, and if Matt Cawthon scrubbed in bright in lace kept her from snapping their noses off for trifles, then they would scrub behind his ears and wrap him in lace like a Sunday gift. "Mud," he said to a pretty smiling maid, spreading her skirts in a curtsy. There was a twinkle in her dark eyes, and the plunging neckline of her bodice displayed a fair amount of bosom to almost rival Rizal's. On another day, he might have taken a little time to enjoy looking.
What mud? I don't see any mud.
Her mouth dropped open, and she forgot to straighten, staring at him with her knees bent as he hobbled away. Jewel and Sandar, rounding a corner quickly, nearly walked into him. The tyrant thief-catcher leaped back with a muffled oath, his swarthy face turning gray until he realized it had almost run him over. Then he muttered an apology and started to hurry on by.
"Has Tom got you mixed into his foolishness, Julin?" Matt asked.
Julin and Tom shared a room deep in the servants' quarters, and there was no excuse for him to be up here. In that dark Tyran coat flaring over his boot tops, Julin would stand out among the servants like a duck in a chicken coop. Suroth was strict about things like that, stricter than Tylin. The only reason for it, Matt could see, was whatever Tom and Beslin were meddling with.
"No, don't bother telling me. I've made an offer to Harnan and the others, and it's open to you, too. If you want to leave, I'll give you the money for it."
Actually, Julin did not look ready to tell him anything. The thief catcher tucked his thumbs behind his belt and met Matt's gaze levelly.
"What did Harnan and the others say? And what is Tom doing that you call foolish? This is one set of rooftops he knows his way around better than you or I."
"The Golem is still in Ebu Dar, Julin."
Tom knew that the game of houses was what he knew, and he loved sticking his nose into politics.
"The thing tried to kill me earlier this evening."
Julin grunted as if he had been hit in the pit of his belly and scrubbed a hand through his short black hair.
"I have a reason to stay a while longer," he said. "Even so."
His air changed slightly to something stubborn and defensive and tinged with guilt. He had never shown a roving eye that Matt had seen, but when a man looked like that, it could only mean one thing.
"Take her with you," Matt said. "And if she won't go, well, you'll not be in Tyr an hour before you have a woman on each knee. That's the thing about women, Julin. If one says no, there's always another will say yes."
A serving man hurrying by with an armload of linen towels stared at Matt's muddiness in amazement, but Julin thought it was at him, and snatched his thumbs free of his belt and attempted to adopt a more humble stance. Without much success. Tom might sleep with the servants, yet from the beginning he had somehow made it seem to be his own choice, an eccentricity, and no one thought it odd to see him up here, perhaps slipping into Rizel's rooms that had once been Matt's. Julin had gone on at length about being a thief catcher, never a thief taker, and stared so many prickly lordlings and complacent merchants in the eye to show he was as good as they that everyone in the palace knew who and what he was. And where he was supposed to be, which was below stairs.
"My lord is wise," he said too loudly, and making a stiff, jerky bow. "My lord knows all about women. If my lord will forgive a humble man, I must return to my place."
Turning to go, he spoke over his shoulder, still in a carrying voice.
"I heard today that if my lord comes back one more time looking like he's been dragged in the street, the queen intends taking a switch to my lord's person."
And that was the stone that broke the wagon clean in two. Flinging open the doors of Tylin's apartments, Matt strode in, sailed his hat across the width of the room, and stopped dead, his mouth hanging open and everything he had planned to say frozen on his tongue. His hat hit the carpets and rolled. He did not see where. A gust of wind rattled the tall, triple-arched windows that led out onto a long, screened balcony overlooking the Molhara. Tylin turned in a chair carved to look like gilded bamboo and stared at him over her golden wine cup. Waves of glossy black hair, touched with gray at the temples, framed a beautiful face with the eyes of a bird of prey, and not one best pleased at the moment. Inconsequential things seemed to leap at him. She kicked her crossed legs slightly, rippling layered green and white petticoats. Pale green lace trimmed the oval opening in her gown that half exposed her full breasts, where the jeweled hilt of her marriage knife dangled. She was not alone. Suroth sat facing her, frowning into her wine cup and tapping long fingernails on the arm of her chair. A pretty enough woman, despite her hair being shaved to that long crest, except that she made Tylin seem a rabbit by comparison. Two of those fingernails on each hand were lacquered blue. Seated at her side was a little girl, of all things, also in an elaborately flowered robe over pleated white skirts, but with a sheer veil covering her entire head.
It seemed to be shaved completely, and wearing a fortune in rubies. Even in a state of shock, he noticed rubies and gold. A slender woman, nearly as dark as her stark black gown, and tall, even had she been Aiel, stood behind the girl's chair with her arms folded and ill-concealed impatience. Her wavy black hair was short, but not shaved at all, so she was neither of the blood nor Sojin. Imperiously beautiful, she put Tylan and Suroth both in the shade. He noticed beautiful women, too, even when he did feel hit in the head with a hammer. It was not the presence of Suroth or the strangers that jerked him to a halt, though. The dice had stopped, landing with a thunder that made his skull ring. That had never happened before. He stood there waiting for one of the Forsaken to leap out of the flames in the marble fireplace, or the earth to swallow the palace beneath him. "You aren't listening to me, Pigeon," Tylan cooed in dangerous tones. "I said, take yourself down to the kitchens and have a pastry until I have time for you. Have a bath while you're about it." Her dark eyes glittered. "We will discuss your mud later." In a daze, he ran it through again in his head. He had walked into the room, the dice had stopped, and nothing had happened. Nothing. "This man has been set upon," the tiny veiled figure said, rising. Her tone turned cold as the wind outside. "You told me the streets were safe, Suroth. I am displeased." Something had to happen. It already should have. Something always happened when the dice stopped. "I assure you, Tuan, the streets of Ebudar are as safe as the streets of Shandar itself," Suroth replied, and that pulled Matt out of his stupor. She sounded anxious. Suroth made other people anxious. A slender, graceful young man in the almost transparent robe of a Dako veil appeared at her side with a tall blue porcelain pitcher, bowing his head and silently offering to replenish her wine. And giving Matt another start. He had not realized anyone else was present in the room. The yellow-haired man in his indecent garment was not the only one, either. A slim but nicely rounded, red-haired woman wearing the same sheer robe was kneeling beside a table that held spice bottles and more fine seafolk porcelain wine pitchers, and a small gilded brass brazier with the pokers needed for heating the wine, while a graying, nervous-eyed serving woman wearing green and white house Mitsubar livery stood at the other end. And in one corner, so motionless that he still almost missed her, yet another Shan Chan, a short woman with half her golden head shaved and a bosom that might outmatch Rizel's if her dress of red and yellow panels had not covered her neck to the chin. Not that he had any real desire to find out. Shan Chan were very touchy about their Sojin. Tylan was touchy about any woman. There had not been a serving woman younger than his grandmother in her apartments since he was able to get out of bed. Suroth looked at the graceful man as though wondering what he was, then shook her head wordlessly and turned her attention back to the child, Tuon, who waved the fellow away. The liveried serving maid scurried forward to take the pitcher from him and try to refill Tylan's cup, but the queen made a very small gesture that sent her back to the wall. Tylan was sitting very, very still. Little wonder that she wanted to avoid notice if this Tuon frightened Suroth, as she plainly did.
"I am displeased, Suroth," the girl said again, sternly frowning down at the other woman. Even standing, she did not have all that far down to stare at the seated High Lady. Matt supposed she must be a High Lady too, only higher than Suroth. "You have recovered much, and that will please the Empress. May she live forever. But your ill-considered attack eastward was a disaster that must not be repeated. And if the streets of this city are safe, how can he have been set upon?"
Suroth's knuckles were white from gripping the chair arm and her wine cup. She glared at Tylan as though the lecture were her fault, and Tylan gave her an apologetic smile and bowed her head. Oh, blood and ashes, he was going to pay for that. "I fell down, that's all." His voice might as well have been fireworks for the way heads whipped around. Suroth and Tuon looked shocked that he had spoken. Tylin looked like an eagle who wanted her rabbit fried. "My ladies," he added, but that did not seem to improve anything. The tall woman suddenly reached out and snatched the wine cup from Tuon's hand, throwing it into the fireplace. Sparks showered up the chimney. The serving woman stirred as if to retrieve the cup before it could be damaged further, then subsided at a touch from the Sojin.
"You are being foolish, Tuon," the tall woman said, and her voice made the girl's sternness seem laughter.
The too familiar Shonchan drawl seemed almost absent entirely.
"Suroth has the situation here well in her control. What happened to the East can happen in any battle. You must stop wasting time on ridiculous trifles."
Suroth gaped at her in astonishment for an instant before she could assume a frozen mask. Matt did a little gaping on his own part. "Use that tone of voice to one of the blood, and you were lucky to escape with a trip to the flogging post." Shockingly, Tuon inclined her head slightly.
"You may be right, Anath," she said calmly, and even with a touch of deference. "Time and the omens will tell. But the young man plainly is lying. Perhaps he fears Tylin's anger. But his injuries clearly are more than he could sustain falling down, unless there are cliffs in the city I have not seen."
"So he feared Tylin's anger, did he? Well, come to that, he did, a little. Only a little, mind. But he did not like being reminded of it." Leaning on his shoulder-high staff, he tried to make himself comfortable. They could ask a man to sit, after all.
"I was hurt the day your lads took the city," he said with his cheekiest grin. "Your lot were flinging around lightning and balls of fire, something fierce. I'm just about healed, though, thank you for asking."
Tylin buried her face in her wine cup and still managed to shoot him a look over the rim that promised retribution later. Tuon's skirts rustled as she crossed the carpets to him. The dark face behind that sheer veil might have been pretty without the expression of a judge passing sentence of death.
"And with a decent head of hair instead of a bald pate."
Her eyes were large and liquid, but utterly impersonal.
All of her long fingernails were lacquered, he noticed, a bright red.
He wondered whether that signified anything. Light, a man could live in luxury for years on the price of those rubies. She reached up with one hand, putting her fingertips under his chin, and he started to jerk back, until Tylin glared at him over Tuon's head, promising retribution here and now if he did any such thing. Glowering, he let the girl shift his head for her study.
"You fought us," she demanded. "You have sworn the oaths?" "I swore," he muttered. "For the other, I had no chance." "So you would have," she murmured.
Circling him slowly, she continued her study, fingering the lace at his wrist, touching the black silk scarf tied around his neck, lifting the edge of his cloak to examine the embroidery. He endured it, refusing to shift his stance, glowering fit to match Tylin. Light, he had bought horses without so thorough an examination. Next, she would want to look at his teeth.
"The boy told you how he was injured,"
Anath said in frosty tones of command.
"If you want him, then buy him and be done. The day has been long, and you should be in your bed."
Tuon paused, examining the long signet ring on his finger. It had been carved as a tri-piece to show the carver's skills, a running fox and two ravens in flight, all surrounded by crescent moons, and he had bought it by chance, though he had come to like it. He wondered whether she wanted it. Straightening, she stared up at his face.
"Good advice, Anath," she said. "How much for him, Tylin? If he is a favorite, name your price, and I will double it."
Tylin choked on her wine and began coughing. Matt almost fell off his staff. The girl wanted to buy him? Well, she might as well have been looking at a horse for all the expression on her face.
"He is a free man, High Lady," Tylin said unsteadily when she could speak. I am. I cannot sell him.
Matt could have laughed if Talon did not sound as though she were trying to keep her teeth from chattering, if Bloody Tuon had not just asked his price.
A free man. Ha!
The girl turned away from him as though dismissing him from her mind.
You are afraid, Talon, and under the light you should not be.
Gliding to Talon's chair, she lifted her veil with both hands, baring the lower half of her face, and bent to kiss Talon lightly, once on each eye and once on the lips. Talon looked astounded.
You are a sister to me and to Surath,
Tuon said in a surprisingly gentle voice.
I myself will write your name as one of the blood. You will be the High Lady Talon, as well as Queen of Altara, and more, as was promised you.
Anath snorted loudly.
Yes, Anath, I know,
the girl sighed, straightening and lowering her veil.
The day has been long and arduous, and I am weary. But I will show Talon what lands are in mind for her, so she will know and be easy in her mind. There are maps in my chambers, Talon. You will honor me by accompanying me there. I have excellent masseuses.
The honor is mine, Talon said, sounding not all that much steadier than before. At a gesture from the Sojin, the yellow-haired man went running to open the door and kneel holding it open, but there was still all the smoothing and adjusting of clothes that women had to do before they would go anywhere, Shonchan or Altaran, or from anywhere else, though the red-haired Dakovale performed the function for Tuon and Surath. Matt took the opportunity to draw Talon a little aside, far enough that he would not be overheard. The Sojin's blue eyes kept coming back to him, he realized, but at least Tuon, excepting the attentions of the slender Dakovale woman, seemed to have forgotten he existed.
I didn't just fall down, he told Talon softly. The Golem tried to kill me not much more than an hour ago. It might be best if I left. The thing wants me, and it'll kill anybody near me, too.
The plan had just occurred to him, but he thought it had a good chance of success. Talon sniffed.
It cannot have you, Piglet.
She directed a look at Tuon that might have made the girl forget about Talon being his sister had she seen.
And neither can she.
At least she had sense enough to whisper.
Who is she? He asked.
Well, it had never been more than a chance.
The High Lady Tuon, and you know as much as I,
Talon replied, just as quietly.
Surath jumps when she speaks, and she jumps when Anath speaks, though I would almost swear that Anath is some sort of servant. They are a very peculiar people, sweetling.
Suddenly she flaked some mud from his cheek with one finger. He had not realized he had mud on his face, too. Suddenly the eagle was strong in her eyes.
Do you recall the pink ribbons, sweetling? When I come back, we'll see how you look in pink.
She swanned out of the room with Tuon and Surath, trailed by Anath and the Sojin and the Dakovale, leaving Matt with the grandmotherly serving woman who began to clean up the wine table. He sank into one of the bamboo-carved chairs and rested his head in his hands. Any other time, those pink ribbons would have had him gibbering. He never should have tried to get his own back with her. Even the Golem did not occupy much of his thoughts. The dice had stopped and... what? He had come face to face, or near enough, with three people he had not met before, but that could not be it. Maybe it was something to do with Talon becoming one of the blood. But always before, when the dice stopped, something had happened to him personally. He sat there worrying over it while the serving woman called in others to carry everything away, sat there until Talon returned. She had not forgotten about the pink ribbons, and that made him forget about anything else for quite a long time.